I want to welcome everyone. I'm Aura Kanagas, Director of the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy of the AFSC. I'd like to start by welcoming all of you on behalf of everyone here at AFSC. We thank you for your support and for your interest in our work. The call today is part of a series where we offer our supporters and our donors a chance to learn more about our work, speaking directly with those who are on the front lines. For those of you who might be new to AFSC, we're a Quaker organization that has been working since 1917 for a world in which all people can live in peace. And most importantly, we understand that peace requires much more than the absence of war and violence. When we work for peace, we need to be ready to work for just social and economic conditions that are necessary to sustain peace in the world. Today I have the pleasure of speaking to you with my colleague, Joseph Gerson, AFSC's Director of Programs for the Northeast Region of AFSC. Joseph and I will focus today specifically on AFSC's recent efforts to impact the federal budget, particularly efforts to shift federal budget priorities away from extraordinarily disproportionate levels of military spending and toward true human security and human needs. So thank you again for joining us, and welcome, Joseph.
Thank you.
I'll start by putting the current moment into a bit of context. We often say that the federal budget is a moral document. It really reflects very directly and concretely what do we care about as a nation. And it also reflects very directly what we do. It is one of the most action-oriented documents that Congress and the White House work together to pass. Much of the wrangling that's taken place between the White House, House, and Senate over the past 2 years of the 112th Congress has played out most intensely over federal budget issues. That's for a variety of reasons. Perhaps most importantly, that budgets are must-pass items. So in a climate where Congress is advancing very little of substance and mostly doing various forms of grandstanding back and forth, the federal budget is one place where something has to give. And this creates, for some, an opportunity for brinksmanship, as was seen last year when congressional leaders attempted to force very deep cuts in domestic programs as a condition of approving a routine increase in the U.S. debt ceiling, which was a move that was needed to avoid defaults on federal obligations. And I apologize for a little bit of wonkiness here, but it will help to sort of paint the picture of the moment that we are about to be upon. So at that point last year, the result of the wrangling back and forth over the debt ceiling was the Budget Control Act, which tasked a congressional supercommittee. Some of you may have heard the supercommittee word kicking around. Others of you are lucky enough to have not paid attention to that. That group was tasked with finding $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction by November 23rd, 2011. And they failed. They couldn't reach a simple majority agreement on any plan. And that automatically triggered what is called a sequester, which was designed to be the pill that would ensure that all parties to the negotiations would have something significant at stake, provide an incentive to compromise, which ultimately it didn't succeed in doing. It mandated $1.2 trillion in cuts to federal spending between 2013 and 2021, and those cuts were to be split evenly between military and non-military programs. That was a law passed by Congress, and Congress can pass another law to undo it. Few in Congress or the White House, for that matter, like the sequester, but it was the stuff of compromise. Few expect the cuts would be allowed to come to pass as is. Many are attempting to make political hay from it, however. We've seen a lot of proposals batted about to undo parts of the sequester, most seeking to actually protect only military spending from cuts. After the elections in November, the grand bargaining will begin again, and in addition to the sequester, the Bush tax cuts are set to expire at the end of the year. So in the six-week lame duck session, the lame duck is the term for a Congress that convenes after an election has happened and their fates are already sealed, the conflict will play out again at a very intense level, we would expect. A few facts which should but don't necessarily inform this debate. 60% of the funds Congress has a direct say over, the discretionary budget, are directed toward the military now. The base budget for the military has doubled in a little over a decade, and that does not include spending on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So just the basic amount that's appropriated has doubled since about 1998. A lion's share of our current debt came from those two wars being waged off budget. So they were not part of the base budget of the military. That was additional spending that was not budgeted for, and that directly contributed to debt. The sequester cuts proposed on the military side are being met with great dismay and gnashing of teeth, particularly by military contractors who threaten that it would cost millions of jobs. The sequester cuts would actually only bring military spending to FY 2007 levels, which was not a bad year for the military. The other dimension of that concern about job cuts is that a UMass study and several others have very clearly documented that federal money spent in almost any other area of the budget creates many more jobs than military spending creates. And in fact, federal military contractors like Lockheed Martin have cut more jobs in years where military spending has increased. So as you hear the news play out over the coming weeks about the deep, deep cuts coming from military spending, I hope you will have those facts in your pocket. And members of Congress really, really need to hear from their constituents as they enter into this grand bargaining stage again. The idea needs to be reinforced that true security is human security, and they really need to hear from constituents that there shouldn't be fear of, quote-unquote, falling off the fiscal cliff. There is no fiscal cliff. There is a fiscal hill. The sequester would be enacted gradually over time and could be reversed at any time. And so nobody should be held hostage to that. So we at AFSC have been taking a variety of approaches to trying to influence the discussion that plays out over the federal budget, from innovative efforts to bring youth videos about what youth in their communities would do if they had $1 trillion that would otherwise have been spent on wars. And one of the things that is most interesting is what's been playing out in AFSC's Northeast region, which Joseph is here to tell you more about.
Okay, so I guess I'm on now. So let me say that over the years, you know, you learn that the good ideas don't necessarily prevail because they're good ideas or the best ideas, that often it requires organizing and grassroots efforts to kind of create the people's power to push those good ideas over the top. Our work on the Budget for All referendum grew out of AFSC's national work and discussions we had with colleagues in what's called AFSC's wage peace efforts. And it's designed to impact in the near term the debate over the budget, particularly as we come into the lame duck session. I'll take credit for having initiated it, but my colleague Paul Shannon has really done yeoman's work in terms of the organizing with the help of one of our interns, Sophia Woolman. Let me say that the goals, just to kind of begin there, our principal goal was simply to begin to increase the debate and discourse over the levels of military spending, which Cora just spelled out, and the need to meet people's real security needs, whether it's housing, medical care, access to education, and a recognition that, you know, in fact, the country is in decline compared to many other industrial societies. We wanted to reinforce the backbone of the Massachusetts congressional delegation as we approach the lame duck session. And having been an organizer in Arizona many years ago, I came to understand the importance of the work that people do in different parts of the country to inspire and encourage the kind of work that we wanted to do in Arizona, which I think applies now. So our hope is that, assuming that we win this referendum, that will encourage other people in other states as we go into the lame duck session. Before going a whole lot further, let me simply read the text of the resolution, then I'll go back and describe a little bit how we did the organizing. It reads, either shall the state senator or the state representative from this district be instructed to vote in favor of a resolution calling among Congress and the President to, one, prevent cuts to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and veterans benefits, or to housing, food, and unemployment assistance. Two, create and protect jobs by investing in manufacturing, schools, housing, renewable energy, transportation, and other public services. Three, provide new revenues for these purposes and to reduce the long-term federal deficit by closing corporate tax loopholes, ending offshore tax havens, and raising taxes on incomes over $250,000. And four, redirect military spending to these domestic needs by reducing the military budget, ending the war in Afghanistan, and bringing U.S. troops home safely now. So let me say a little bit about how we got into this. Our program some years ago initiated and really provided the leadership and hard work for a referendum that we won overwhelmingly, I think about 63 communities, calling for the withdrawal of Massachusetts National Guard forces from Iraq. So we had some experience with this kind of thing. We had brought together people working on national budget priorities from both western Massachusetts and eastern Massachusetts in a formation called Fund Our Communities, Not War, and we were trying to figure out what we might do to really move this forward. And that's where the idea of doing the referendum came from. And that led to a decision to consult with a number of potential partners about what they would want out of such a referendum and how they might contribute. And we began bringing a number of organizations in. You can find an awful lot of information about the campaign on the Budget for All website, which is BUDGET4, the number, allmass.org. So that's where you can find a lot of information about it. But our key partners were Peace Action here in Massachusetts, the local of the Government Employees Union, Dorchester Peoples for Peace, the Chinese Progressive Association, and especially the Mass Alliance of HUD Tenants. They've just done yeoman's work on this as well. So that was our basic core. We did a lot of consulting and negotiating over the text of the referendum. There were a number of compromises all around, but I think a recognition that if any of us were to seek to achieve our goals and our priorities, we needed to work together. And in fact, it's led to the creation of, ideal or model kind of coalition for progressive social change, the peace movement, low-income people and communities of color, organized labor. We were also able to win a number of endorsements from both members of Congress and from a number of state representatives. And at this stage in the game, they're helping us with some of the public events where they'll be speaking. We had to do some interesting research of the laws. Responding to one of the questions that was sent in ahead of time, we're well within the limits of what could be done by a nonprofit organization in terms of lobbying. But we had to deal with firsthand learning that what we can do is a non-binding resolution. In Massachusetts, the only binding votes that people can do are for constitutional changes in the state constitution. But we had to collect signatures by either state senate district or state rep district. Not so easy. In a place like Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I am, it's divided between three different state senate districts, and you've got to get people's signatures on the right form or it doesn't count. We then did the hard work of soliciting petition signatures. It's a bit of a challenge when so many people on the streets are plugged into their iPods or phones. But we got 25,000 signatures across the state, which we're told is the largest ever gathered for a non-binding resolution in the state. So now what we're doing is producing literature, organizing public events, where Barney Frank, Representative McGovern, and others will be speaking. We're doing media outreach, both focusing on local media and social media. And we're just beginning to think about what we do on the other side of Election Day, which will include really pressing a number of members of the state legislature to pass the resolution. Just because we vote for it doesn't mean they automatically pass it. We'll be trying to do as much media work as we can to kind of spread the word of a victory, to encourage people in other states to kind of grow their own backbone, as our governor once said, to press for a decent outcome in the lame duck session. We'll be doing, I think, with our colleagues across the country, a lot of work trying to mobilize public opinion toward members of Congress, and we'll be doing some additional planning with our wage peace colleagues. And just to close in saying that, you know, we've been through a lot of crises before, and we tend not to take them so seriously. You know, it's just another one coming. But the reality is that if we have anything like the Ryan budget, which is what the House is pressing for, the Republicans are pressing for, what we're going to find in not so long from now is a government that consists of a military, of prisons and homeland security. And, you know, as a country, we're really falling behind the other industrialized countries in terms of medical care, in terms of education, in terms of public transportation, you name it. And, you know, those of us who have kids and grandkids, you know, I really feel an obligation to provide the kind of society that's going to make it possible for them to thrive. So I'll cut off there and look forward to people's questions.
I'll just say that the plan for this call was to focus on the federal budget, but I did see that the announcement that went out suggested we were available to talk about policy issues more broadly. So I know some of the advance questions were more general in nature, and we're here to be a resource, so happy to answer the questions that you have. One of the questions that came by email that I thought was interesting is, you know, what do we say about just war? And to me, in some ways, this is a budget question. We hit what we head for as a country. So by investing so heavily in military tools to the exclusion of other tools in our federal budget, we really haven't got much to work with when global problems arise. So our old tools and attitudes are stretched quite awkwardly across a new global template of interdependence and a fast-changing world. So you see, you know, there are changes in China. Oh, well, we'll move the same old military equipment and strategies to the Pacific Rim. You know, you're having a problem with non-state actors? We send drones. Mass violence in Syria? Well, we need to demand regime change and ignore the roots of the problem and ignore the regional context that could have an impact. So again and again, U.S. and global institutions are failing to fundamentally update our objectives or toolkit for response. So I think the question needs to not be, you know, is there just war? It can be, you know, what are actually the problem-solving tools that address what we see before us? And a war has almost never, and in my view, never actually solved the conflict. It can sometimes shift the conditions for what the ultimate talks that need to take place include, but it isn't the talks, and the talks are what solves the conflict. So I think changes in our federal budget are one of the things most important to changing that frame of just war, and I could go on for days about just war, and I'm sure Joseph could as well.
I'll just pick up a little bit on that, Aura, just to say that, you know, every time the United States faces a significant problem internationally, not every time, but many times, or when it has particular ambitions like control of oil in the Middle East, you know, we have a new and different Hitler, and that mobilizes the people. When, you know, the United States, as you see with reactions throughout the Middle East in response to that horrible video, with the numbers of people that we've killed and the number of communities we've destroyed, through those wars, whether it's Iraq, even the sanctions going in the 1990s that killed more than 500,000 children, you know, people in many parts of the world, you know, don't see us the way we do. The other thing that I think is sort of fundamentally important, and you see playing out in the lame duck session, it was just over 50 years ago that President Eisenhower warned of the power and influence of the military-industrial complex. And over that period of time, now 5 decades, that complex has increased and deepened its power, and as Eisenhower said, it really subverted our democratic process. And I think what we see in the struggle over the budget in the lame duck session is really a question about how we identify the nature of our society. Or I was talking about it, it's about values. And this is fundamental. It's about also real security. Are you safer because we're spending, $350 billion in the next decade for nuclear weapons, or in having medical care and people not being thrown out of their homes because of foreclosures? I mean, what is real security when it comes down to our lives? While I'm here, I'll just pick up one of the other questions, which has to do with how we can prevent a nuclear war growing out of the Middle East. I think the assumption there was in relationship to Iran. And I think the two things to say are, one, that we've advocated the negotiations of a Middle East nuclear weapons free zone, which has been called for by the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference, and the United States has supported this. You know, the Israelis will say that they live in a dangerous neighborhood, and the reality is that Iran lives just down the block from Israel, which has, you know, more than 200 nuclear weapons. And I think the way to go is to be seriously committed to a nuclear weapons-free zone. And it was an interesting challenge. I don't particularly like the Iranian government, but in the meeting of the non-aligned nations, Ahmadinejad threw out the challenge that the nuclear powers should eliminate their nuclear arsenals by 2025. In fact, they're treaty-bound to negotiate the complete elimination of the nuclear weapons. So I think one way to really stanch nuclear weapons proliferation and to create greater security is for the U.S. and other nuclear powers to fulfill their obligations under the NPT, begin to remove the double standard, which says it's okay for us to have nuclear weapons, it's okay for us to increase spending for nuclear weapons by $100 billion over a decade, but you can't have them. In an era of this technology, that doesn't work, and it only leads to greater dangers.
Aura, a lot of people seem to be concerned about AFSC's tax exemption status and doing the policy and advocacy work about the percentage of the budget.
Sure.
Yeah.
So having worked for both 501c3 and 501c4 organizations in the past, a 501c3 organization can only spend a small percentage of its overall budget on advocacy-related activities. And the definition of lobbying is, you know, sort of the direct, advocating a direct position on a piece of legislation or sort of specific policy proposal. We're well below I think it's a 10% test. The percentage of our overall budget that is spent on advocacy-related activities is very small. So we're in fine shape. One of the things that makes AFSC special is that we don't just take approaches that put Band-Aids on issues. We recognize the systemic nature of, you know, the communities in poverty that we work with, of the places, you know, of the wars that have racked the world. We recognize that there are systemic elements that can be addressed and prevented at the policy level. So it's very much a seamless part of our work, but it's one that we're well within the law in carrying out. Does that answer the question?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much. Well, we have an abundance of callers on the line. I do hope that you all take the time to ask your questions now while you have experts on the line that can tell you exactly what you need to know. So, again, if you have any questions, introduce yourself and ask away.
Just to say, I want to say hello to Pat Elder if he's out there. I got your question.
Yeah, I am, Joe. I do remember our work
with the Enola Gay and the Smithsonian, and just glad to see you keeping on, keeping on. I mean, there were a number of questions related to the No Child Left Behind and the whole process of military access to the schools and to school records.
Right.
And what I wanted to say in this regard was this is not a focus of my work, but we're doing some really fine cutting-edge work out of our office in Western Massachusetts. They've, in addition to the work they do going into the schools with information about alternatives to military service and opt-out forms that they have, they've been doing a study now, including public records requests of the schools out in Western Massachusetts of the degree to which they comply with the law. What are they doing in terms of opt-out? What do they do in terms of access to the military, in terms of access of alternative perspectives? And they'll be coming out with, I think, a fairly significant report about that, which they'll use to hold the school systems accountable and, I think, to get greater access to the students so they know their rights.
Well, that sounds good.
You can be in touch with, just say you can be in touch with Jeff Napolitano, who's our program coordinator there, and you can catch his email address and phone number on AFSC's webpage.
Okay, I appreciate that. Yeah, my work, Joe, has been focused around the ASVAB, which is the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. Maybe I can send an email later, maybe just to send one letter to your Massachusetts Superintendent of Schools. Massachusetts continues to test kids, and Maryland's the only state so far to have enacted a law that prohibits the automatic release of student information.
That's
to the Pentagon. And that's
great.
All we're trying to do. And
great.
It's
that's
tough getting it on anybody's radar screen.
Good. Keep it up.
Okay. Yeah, buddy. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Pat. We have another caller that looks like they want to ask a question. Hello?
Was that me?
Yes,
am
it is.
I on?
Yes.
My name is Claire. I'm listening from Fort Collins, Colorado. I'm actually a member of Saratoga Monthly Meeting, but I'm sojourning here in Colorado. Thanks for all the work you're doing. I just have a sort of dumb question. It wasn't clear to me, you used, Joseph Gerson, you used the word resolution and referendum. I'm not clear. Are the voters of Massachusetts being asked to respond to a referendum in this November election?
Well, what will happen will be, because of the organizing we did, the question which I read will appear on 1 million ballots, and it... What it does is it directs either their state representative to vote for a resolution addressed to members of Congress that calls for them to act with those 4 points. So it comes initially to the state legislature, where we'll be working with them to pass a resolution. But even before we have the resolution, our hope is that as we can get the word out across the country about a victory, that it will encourage people to take action, to call their members of Congress, to write letters to their editor, and so on.
So can I get specific information and the wording of the resolution on that website that you mentioned?
Yes, you can. It's all there, along with a number of articles about the campaign.
Okay. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Anyone else have any questions?
I will say that I hope that some on the call do take the recommendation, even if you're not in Massachusetts with a handy-dandy ballot initiative to help you do so. You also can ask your members of Congress to approach federal budget priorities in a way that takes your community's needs more into account, that addresses the kinds of things that make your family and your community feel more secure, an intact safety net, programs that are addressed are sustainable energy sources that are clean and can help us avoid further destruction to climate. The many, many other things that the power of government can be put behind, besides spending more on military infrastructure than any other nation in the world and most of our potential, quote-unquote, enemies combined.
And allies.
And allies, right.
Are there any other questions? We had some new callers just join us, so thank you all for calling in. Aura, I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm not too familiar with the process of lobbying.
Hmm.
Can you explain that a little bit and how AFSC differs? I'm pretty sure we're unique in how we go about our discussions on the Hill.
Mm-hmm. Well, lobbying, is just a fancy way of saying, asking your elected representatives to represent you, to do what will serve your interests, your family's interests, your community's interests. The introduction of money and power dynamics into politics means that a lot of the lobbying that goes on in Washington is pretty slick stuff. But at the end of the day, money doesn't vote, and people have a fundamental level of power that is sort of ours for the taking if we really get involved in our political process and don't just show up every 2 years at the voting booth, but pay attention to what our members of Congress do in between election years. And don't just pay attention to what the newspaper says they're doing, but actually do a little research, follow organizations like AFSC, like SCNL, other organizations of your choice, to see what they're really doing and track their voting records and be in a conversation with your members of Congress. I think it can feel like a futile gesture to go talk to a representative whose views seem 100% opposed to your own. But I'd say two things about that. One is that views can shift over time, and sometimes it's when you hear what has changed a member's perspective on an issue over time. It was, one steadfast person in their district who kept coming back again and again and made the issue real to them and changed their view over time. Now, I've been working in Washington for 17 years, and I am not doe-eyed about the degree to which special interests play an incredible role, and there are members of Congress who will never buck them. But I do think that a more active democracy where people are in front of their member of Congress or the staff for their member of Congress at regular intervals sharing their perspectives from direct experience is best. One of the things that AFSC does uniquely in our lobbying is to really try to bring the voice of our direct experience and expertise to bear on public policy. So instead of just advocating for particular positions on immigration, we, for example, bring a group of youth from the Newark area who families have been impacted by immigration policy. They have a parent who's been deported or detained, or there is some other way in which their lives have been deeply affected by immigration policy, and we bring them to talk about those impacts rather than just citing numbers on a page. You and your community can bring to life what federal budget choices, for example, mean in your life, how cuts in Pell Grants have affected your ability to send your kids to college, and how we're willing to spend $1 trillion on fancy weapon systems, but somehow our pockets get tighter when it comes to human needs. So that's kind of a snapshot of how we lobby and how you can lobby.
Again, if you have any questions, you can just hit *7 on your phone, and that will unmute you and give you an opportunity to get the answers straight from the experts here at AFSC. I tell you, our staff are so knowledgeable, and I appreciate them sharing their time with us each month to bring this knowledge to everyone. The work that they do is very, very important, and at times they're not recognized, and it's really the butter on the bread, per se, when it comes to change in the world. And
that's the nicest compliment I've ever heard. I've never been compared to butter, and I wish it would happen more often.
I was thinking, it's good. it's good for AFSC's donors to butter our bread. We like that too. I was going to only half a step off subject to talk about something that we're doing on a national basis and in association with AFSC staff in China and working in Korea. I want to call people's attention to really a fundamental shift in U.S. Foreign and military policy enunciated by Secretary Clinton at the beginning of the year, which she described as a pivot away from Iraq and Afghanistan and toward Asia and the Pacific. And the recent Pentagon defense guidance essentially says that the two primary foci of U.S. Military policy are maintaining control of the Persian Gulf and maintaining U.S. dominance in the Asia-Pacific region. And this is driving a rather huge military buildup, more bases around China, new weapon systems, the whole ball of wax, the destruction of communities. I have a particular soft spot in my heart for the people of Guam, the Chamorros of Guam, who are, it's basically a culture that's being destroyed by the expanding U.S. military bases. And we've organized a thing called the Working Group for Peace and Demilitarization in Asia and the Pacific. We're still in the early startup stages. Actually, just had a very interesting meeting yesterday, which brought together leading peace movement figures, people from the Asian American community, scholars, and fairly senior people from the religious community. Where this links with the subject of the call, of course, is that military buildup is what's driving a lot of the weapons acquisition, a lot of the military spending, over and above the kind of bureaucratic drives and the drive for corporate profit. And we're in the process of exploring some ways in which we can both produce resources to help educate people about this and its relationship to the budget and the need to be investing in real security, as well as, I think, some interesting possibilities in terms of national and international campaigning. So I just wanted to let people know that we're doing this. I think it's at the cutting edge, and we look forward to people kind of supporting us as we go.
Thank you, Joseph. I see, again, our staff has been so knowledgeable that all our callers can do is go out now and write their Congress people because they're in the know and they know what to say. Can you all share with everyone some final thoughts on how to get in touch with you or how to support you in your continued work?
Sure, yeah. You can get in touch with me. The contact info is on the AFSC website, but my email is akanegis, akanegis, at afsc.org. Or the phone number here in the office is 202-483-3341, and I'm extension 106. I think you can do exactly what you're doing, showing up and listening and learning and paying attention to what's happening politically in the world is one of the things that I think can restore our democracy. And I'm very pleased so many of you have joined us today.
So from my end, the way to reach me is at jgerson, that's J-G-E-R-S-O-N, at afsc.org. And the phone number here in Cambridge is 617-661-6130. In terms of what people can do, I think what I would suggest is taking some of the literature about national budget priorities, either from the AFSC webpage or Budget for All campaigns, some information about that, print some of it out, and in gatherings either with friends or in your church, synagogue, mosque, in your union, whatever your community might be, share some information about that. The people are actually doing something to make change, and encourage them to think with you about what two or three things you and they might do consistent with trying to cut military spending and really provide real security for people here. You know, democracy, there's the old saying, you get what you deserve. I'm not sure that's really quite true, but, you know, ultimately there is the power of the people, and if we don't exercise that power, then others are going to exercise it on us. I'm just really concerned about the world my grandson's going to inherit and what his options are going to be.
Well said, Joseph. Thank you very much. Well, I'd like to thank all of you for joining us this evening. I hope it was pleasant for you. I hope it was knowledgeable for you, which I'm sure it was. And hopefully you can join us in the future. Thank you, Joseph. Thank you, Aura. Y'all are great, and thank you for all the great work that you do. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for setting it up.
Thanks, Tay.
No problem. Everyone have a safe evening. and be well.